We've had many notable and distinguished individuals appear on this campus as commencement speakers, but probably none whose face and voice are so well known to an audience as our speaker today, Mr. Raymond Burr, star of television and motion pictures. Most of you know him as Perry Mason or as Chief Robert T. Ironside. In fact, some students wanted to know had I thought ahead enough to have built a ramp up here in order for him to get up on top of this platform. That shows you the power of television. Mr. Burr won Emmys for 2 years in a row as the best actor in a leading role. In two subsequent years, he won the TV Guide Award as the most popular male personality. Those of you who saw him in the role of Pope John XIII in the NBC special in April saw another prize-winning performance for which he should receive many honors. But to many Cal Poly students and alumni, one of Mr. Burr's prize-winning performances occurs each year during the Pasadena New Year's Rose Parade, when he describes to millions of viewers the Cal Poly Rose Float. His interest in what the students have done in creating these floats has led him to inspect the inner mechanical workings of Cal Poly floats during the construction period. And while he was on campus today, we took him out and he met with the committee and looked again at the plans for this next year's float. His interest in growing rare orchids and in landscape gardening, hobbies which he pursues at his home in Hollywood, has become a topic of conversation with Cal Poly students. Another mutual interest with many Cal Poly students is his copra plantation in Itoba and the Fiji group, which is his second home. Mr. Burr is something of a one-man AID program in helping the local people of those islands with education and economic development. And I had the pleasure of talking with him for quite a while at noon today. And I should say that he has a considerable broader grasp of education and the problems at all levels of education than many educators that I know. And these days, when graduating students are not all assured of exactly the kind of a job they want for the rest of their lives, one can take comfort in the knowledge that Mr. Burr had that experience in the Depression, and he made it pay off for him. When acting jobs were few and far between, he held a series of temporary jobs, each of which contributed to the amazing background knowledge he has of a great many fields. He worked for J.C. Penney, the U.S. Forestry Service, as a ranch hand, salesman, deputy sheriff, radio announcer, and he's no stranger to the academic community, having taught drama at Columbia University in 1940, at the Pasadena Playhouse in 1942, and also at San Jose State. He served in the U.S. Navy in World War II, and his continued interest in the welfare of military service personnel led him to record more than 3,000 radio shows for troops overseas. His motion picture career encompasses 90 films, and his earlier stage acting took him from his native Canada to England and to New York's Broadway. Please join me in welcoming to our stage Mr. Raymond Burr.
President Kennedy, Mr. Bennett, Mr. Hoffman, the class of 73, honored guests, ladies and gentlemen, commencement, a beginning, a start. You are sitting here today, breathing easily, comfortably tired in the knowledge that these many years in the groves of academia have been successfully, perhaps even brilliantly, certainly, finally, concluded. And that today's ritual formally marks the end of something or other. Now, while it might seem unseemly to bring a stern note to these proceedings, let us have the minor key for just a moment in this otherwise glad and triumphant celebration. Well, while you have put in a good deal of time, training, warming up, stretching, and rehearsing, it is only now, today, that cap, gown, diploma, and all, you put your foot on the starting block, one knee to the ground, and the starter raises his gun. It is not, sadly, the best of all possible races into which you are going. Not perhaps at this moment in history the most honest. It is, however, the only race. A course that has been run fairly with honor, real honor, before, and can be run with honor, real honor, again. Certainly it would be unrealistic to think that there have not always been some flaws, arrogances, hypocrisies, and abuses mixed with the courage and truths, the gallantry and morality of the contest, though the events of our own times always seem more poignant to us, or blacker and more dramatic, without the cool perspective of history. But, crouched there waiting for the signal to be off, you are probably not going to thank me for disenchantment, for the news that the track is torn up in several places, and that the finish line may just possibly be mined by the time you get there. In fact, you already know that. So I'm not going to address myself to the negative aspects, the pitfalls and treacheries you may meet, but rather to the desirability of running the race. The paramount need to win it, and perhaps a few guesses at how. To start, let us agree that there are limitations to being a spectator. I will not carry the athletic metaphor to absurdity, but there is a further parallel that occurs. Consider the theory that games and sports represent, for the people actively engaged in them, a series of artificial frustrations, whether they are baskets, goalposts, nets, or simply stopwatches, frustrations which can be and have been overcome. This overcoming, as practically all of us know, can be greatly rewarding, ranging from the simple pleasure of establishing your superiority and sway over a golf ball to the extraordinary catharsis of contact sports. Now, symbolic as these obstacles may be, the conquering of a basketball net or the making of a contract in bridge is a very real pleasure and a very real accomplishment for the player. Now, you're probably thinking that countless millions of people get a similar, if maybe less pungent, pleasure from watching highly trained amateurs or professionals conquering these artificial frustrations. You're wondering if I'm seriously proposing that there is something bloodless and pale in participating secondhand in the rituals of television watching in the ballpark. Let me say here and now that I enjoy, on television and in person or however, almost all sports, whether played by multimillionaires or country high schools or little league teams. Since we have just defined these rituals as a form of theater, I not only like, but understand and support them. My point is that one must not confuse the spectator with the sport. In Spain, bullfighting is explained as being a kind of theater, a noble ceremony which provides most of the time a victory in abstract over the representative evils of the bull. The passion of the spectators at a corrida is manifestly involved and awesome to see in its naked need. A form of theater of cruelty, theater of blood, theater of life and death, but still theater.
No matter how much satisfaction may have been given to see Luis Miguel Dominguin keel a Miura bull, or how many touchdowns and or passes Joe Namath may make, you will still be the spectator. And to Namath and Dominguin will belong the victory. Now, what about victory? What is it? I'm sure that all of us, at one time or another, have thought that whoever said, it's not whether you win or lose that counts, it's how you play the game, was either an A, single-minded enthusiast of form and style, or B, someone who didn't play the game very well at all. Now, while not putting down those necessary qualities of form and sportsmanship, generosity and skill, it does occur to me that winning is the point. There are, to be sure, moral victories, just as there are Pyrrhic ones. There are ways, as any seasoned parent can tell you, of winning by losing. We've all known those people who make a profession of being noble in defeat, and their close kin who are contemptible in victory. And while there are immediately identifiable losers, it's a bit more difficult to characterize your true blue 14-carat full-fledged winner. Now, Mark Spitz is one order of winner. Helen Keller was quite another. Until perhaps 60 days ago, we would have probably all agreed that the handsome Brooks brothers suited, superbly married, top-of-their-fields young men of the White House were winners. And in a rather odd way, Alice Cooper is a winner. But of course, there are far more winners than those typified by these household names. In my personal and humble opinion, the largest, most uniform group of winners this country has ever known has been the Peace Corps. Another group, not so uniform in mission or language, but infinitely large in number, is that peaceable army of foreign students educated in this country and ultimately carrying back to their homes not necessarily what the State Department wanted them to take back, not necessarily what good public relations would have them take back, but what they needed individually, particularly, uniquely. They are surely winners for what they got. How much more so are we who were able to give them what they needed? Well, that's one kind of winning. But more importantly, it's an indication of some of the qualities that constitute winning. Now, some guesses as to how. An actor, if he's involved over a long period of time, can become very grossed in winning. Such is the case of a friend of mine who, for several years, played the chief of surgery in one of the serials set in the hospitals. Now, he can no longer go into a real hospital to visit anyone without the conditioned reflex of his role taking over. His eyes narrow, shoulders straighten, he snaps at the nurses. He's sullen with the orderlies, and the set of his mouth expresses disgust with just about everything. And quite naturally, the patients and staff respond to him as if he were good old Dr. Gillespie himself. Now, in a way, something of a similar nature has happened to me. For 16 years now, I've been involved with two fictional characters, both of whom are exemplars of the law. Because of the professional requirements and a purely personal interest, my involvement in education became quite deep for a layman. My acquaintances and friends in the world of jurisprudence have become numerous and abiding. And out of that interest and love for the law, I've learned a few things that have direct relation to to the topic of winning. Although the law of our country is based on English common law, a system and tradition that goes back to Magna Carta, and although there are some areas, shall we say, insensitive to the times, the law itself embodies principles that can be translated to lifestyles and ethics of immense use to us all. And the basic, irreducible minimum is that it is, the law is, as one must be to be a winner, flexible. Whether the code, the law, whether it be the code Napoleon, Blackstone, Hammurabi, or the Lex Romana, is a living, changing entity, elastic and moving to encompass need, yet firm, purposeful, and solid. Now, please don't mistake my meaning here. I am not discussing compromise or accommodation or expedience. The word is flexible. If the wings of a large jet aircraft did not flex, they would break off. If the top of the Empire State Building or the new building in Chicago did not sway with the wind, the building would collapse. No human relationship could survive without some give and take. Now, you're all thinking, I'm sure, of 1,000 examples, and none of them suggest compromise. They suggest wisdom, intelligence, balance, and order. Now, let me say simply what I've actually come to say. If our being here together today is to have any meaning at all, it's this. Don't be satisfied with the second-hand experience of others. You cannot hope to profit from the borrowed awareness or actions of surrogates. In other words, involvement. The kind that leads to success is a gut-level business, a first-person, primary level of engagement. I was 17 or 18, I was driving home early one morning after an all-night talk session with a very, very, very close friend, worldly, erudite, and exceedingly handsome woman, twice my age, or perhaps a little more. She was a psychoanalyst. I was not one of her patients, but she did give generous amounts of time to me as I wrestled in those years with all the problems, quandaries, and decisions that worried me at that time. The point is that she was wise, informed, and unstinting in her desire to help. Now, this night we were driving home. We'd been talking, listening to each other for some 6 or 7 hours. I was still turning over in my mind a lot of the good things she had said to me, when quite suddenly the thought hit me that has influenced my life to this day. No matter how varied and instructive the advice of my friends, no matter how deep their love or friendship, no matter how wise or how concerned, no one on earth could ever help me except myself. Now, this may strike all of you as a blinding flash of the obvious, but until it has struck you, as it did me, alone, as you can only be alone, driving just before dawn, you cannot imagine the strength that comes from such a realization. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I suppose we could have saved much time and effort if I had just recited Polonius' advice to Laertes to you. But I wanted to be here today to see you off, to wish you luck, and to share this commencement, this beginning, with all of you. I thank you for that.
shall not want. He maketh me lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. He righteousness for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death,
though I walk through the valley of the shadow,
before me in the presence of my enemy.
Thou anointest my head with oil.
My cup runneth over.
To see your smile.
with the candle by the water's side, to see the little children when they truly baptize. On, unto the dying land. King Jesus with the candle by the water's side, to see the little children when they truly baptize. On, unto the dying land. Oh, run along, children, and be baptized. There's a mighty pretty meeting by the water's side. On, unto the dying land. Oh, run along, children, and be baptized. There's a mighty pretty meeting by the water's side. On, unto the dying land. I pray now.
He was also a member of the Men's Glee Club, singing under the direction of H.P. Davidson. And as you know, Mr. Davidson is now retiring after 37 years of dedicated service to Cal Poly. In fact, the singing of the alma mater at the end of this program today, a song written by Mr. Davidson, will be the final performance of any musical organization of this university under Mr. Davidson's direction. Now, Mr. Brophy has an announcement and a presentation to make. And will the student escorts please bring Mr. Davidson to the platform? And he doesn't know about this, so bring him here, please.
Thank you, President Kennedy. While we're getting Davy up here, I'd just like to mention that about this the doctorate gown I wear today, I think I should explain to the faculty that I do only have a bachelorate. But the uniform of the day for trustees is a doctorate gown, but which must prove that if you're not smart enough to get a doctorate, you can just become a trustee. And I appreciate Dr. Kennedy calling me Mr. Brophy. It's quite a change from what he used to call me when I was a student. Davy, come over here. We have a little story to tell you, sir. And it goes back to the days that I sang in your glee club and listened to the same stories you're telling today, but The only saving grace in those stories is the fact that students do graduate, so you have a new flock. But anyway, stand over here and stop shivering. You used to do this to me for so long, and it's my turn to turn the tables just for a moment. What we're going to tell you about today started with President Kennedy, but it wasn't all President Kennedy. The faculty was involved, but it wasn't all the faculty. I was involved, but it certainly wasn't all me. And the students here were involved. The Glee Club was involved. But it wasn't all the Glee Club. I'd prefer to believe that it's a demonstration of the heartfelt love and affection that comes from the tens of thousands of students that have passed through your beautiful hands in the past 37 years. But I'll tell you what it has to do with, and I want to prove you're wrong about something for a change, sir. But I need your help. What's the name of the building where your office is? The
Music, Speech, and Drama.
Yeah, well, you're wrong. Because I have a resolution here that says, the following proposed resolution was adopted by the Board of Trustees in executive session this May 22nd, 23rd, 1973 meeting. It was resolved by the Board of Trustees, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that the music wing of the Music, Speech, and Drama Building on campus at the California Polytechnic State University, San Luis Obispo, shall be designated as the H.P. Davidson Music Center. I'll just speak this. I'm not through yet.
You have to be dead to get that, you know.
You're going to speak in a minute, Dad.
No, I'm not. Be dead. Bob Kennedy told me that.
Right. Well, Davy, I didn't tell you, but my contribution to that was that I stood up before Glenn Dumke, raised my hand, and said, "You can't tell the difference."
Still a wise ass.
Well, I finally got him for a straight man. But in this bound volume, you'll find the signature of the faculty, students, glee clubs, and all your friends. And every page you'll note is marked confidential. And believe me, it's the most confidential and the best kept secret that's ever happened here at Cal Poly. Thank you. Davy?
Thank you, Rick. All right. I can't thank you enough. This has been obviously the happiest years of my life, and I am proudest most that you're all friends, and I regard you as friends. Roy, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Bob.